Now, as we deal with education, there's one other thing I want to deal with, and that is Bush's education plan. Now, I have to tell you, when this plan came out, I was furious. I said, of all the stupid, idiotic things that anybody has ever come up with, Bush's education plan has to be the worst. Leave no child behind. And in the end, I was saying what he really meant is leave no rich child behind, because here's the way the system would work. Here's the school systems of a state of Pennsylvania. We're going to test the kids in the school at the end of the school year. And we're going to have a standard. And the schools that do not measure up to the standard will lose their funding. And I'm saying, this is insane. If a school isn't functioning well, if the kids aren't learning in that school, instead of cutting the funding, you ought to be doing just the opposite. How can we bring more resources into the school? How can we make the system work better? Every logic of any liberal observer would say, this system will not work. And the teachers began to complain. They say, all we're doing is educating people to pass tests. And Bush administration was saying, that's right. We're going to test them in terms of whether they can read and write and do arithmetic. What a novel idea. The kids should come out of school learning how to read and write and do arithmetic. Yeah, that's what we're going to test them on. But what about the other things? The culture, the art, the music, all important. But so far as Bush was concerned, what? Secondary. If they don't know how to read and write and do arithmetic, all this other stuff is superfluous. Does that sound like good Republican thinking? So I assumed that this was doomed to failure. Lo and behold, and you get this book that I wrote, Red Letter Christians, and you think it's going to be all left-wing stuff. Get to the chapter on education. Before I point out what is obvious, the reports now are coming back. In these inner city schools where kids didn't know how to read and write and do arithmetic, suddenly the scores are going up, not a little bit, dramatically. The teachers are teaching the kids how to read and write and do arithmetic, because if they don't teach them how to do read and write and do arithmetic, the money's going to be cut off. And they're scared to death that their school system's going to lose the money and they're going to be out of jobs. And suddenly they are intent on making sure that inner city kids will learn how to read and write and do arithmetic. What about those kids from the government housing projects? Hey, I got them in my class. That's the labeling that they have. Whether they're labeled this way or not, I don't care. They got to learn how to read and write, or this school is going to test badly. What's even worse is, and the book in Freakonomics has this so well. What's worse is, I'm going to lose my job, because if my class doesn't perform well, if my class of students performs poorly, and the class next door is performing excellent work, it's not going to be long before the principal looks over and says, I think we got to get rid of Campolo. He's dragging down the school. He's not teaching adequately. No, up to this point, teachers were never compared to teachers. All of a sudden, teachers are compared to teachers. That book on Freakonomics says, well, this is what happens when teachers start getting compared to teachers. And all of a sudden, the teachers start competing against each other, working overtime to make sure that their kids do well, because they don't want to look inferior to the teacher who's teaching the same kind of kids next door. Do you begin to see this? And all of a sudden, laissez-faire competition, which is the Republican mantra, is demonstrating that it's working brilliantly in inner city schools. And inner city kids in the United States, as the tests, and I have the results, you look at the footnotes there, there's 1,500 footnotes in that book. Check the footnotes and you will find the studies that will in fact show you the evidence, the empirical evidence, that they're testing better and better and better. It shouldn't work. Liberal ideology says it shouldn't work. The only way you're going to improve education is what? And the Republicans love this one. Liberals always say, the only way you're going to improve the system is throw more money at it. And they're saying, no, we're going to do just the opposite. If you're not doing well, we're going to take the money away. And all of a sudden, intensive competition changed the whole nature of what's going on in schools in America. And it scares me a bit. Because I hear both Obama and Hillary Clinton saying what? We are going to do away with the Leave No Child Behind program. And I'm saying, shut up. It's the only thing that I've seen work in the last 20 years in inner city schools. I don't like it. It runs contrary to my ideological expectations. Back to the serendipity pattern. I would have expected that everything would be downgraded. And teach, have you ever talked to teachers about this program? They complain and complain and complain. I can't teach them art. I can't teach them music. I have to teach them to pass these tests. That's right. And all of a sudden, we're getting a generation of kids who know how to do reading and writing and arithmetic, who know how to read an essay and comprehend what they've read. Isn't this a tragedy? Do you understand why conservatives have a very perfect right to come back and yell at the liberal establishment at this point? This is why red-letter Christians, as I say in this book, are neither Democrats or Republicans. We want to look at the empirical evidence. And we want to support programs that work. We're pragmatists. And so I say in the book, in the opening chapter, whenever anybody asks me, are you a Democrat or a Republican? My question immediately is, what's the issue? If you're talking about education, I'm a Republican. If you're talking about some other things, I'm a Democrat. It goes back and forth. Thomas.
Yeah, but aren't we just teaching kids how to pass tests? Can they necessarily read a book or really enjoy it?
You don't understand. They couldn't read at all. You say, you're kidding me. Remember when I talked about Edison High and I said these kids do not know anything? They've been pushed ahead. You have no idea how often kids in these urban schools were pushed ahead from one class to the next without knowing how to read or write and do arithmetic. They were just passed through the system, came out the other end as functional illiterates, turned loose in a world where they couldn't function. It's true. Maybe they can only read a paragraph, but maybe that's all you have to be able to do to work in certain situations. And the point is, you're right. Maybe they can't read a book, but if you can't read at all,
And another thing, I think that I've read from, not in all circumstances, but especially in inner city schools, it has the pressure, or teachers have the pressure to make their kids succeed, and often maybe encouraged to find deviant ways of getting around the system.
Isn't that an unusual thing? I mean, imagine pressuring the teachers to teach.
Well, I mean, to cheat for their students.
Oh, yeah. And actually, there's all kinds of studies. And in the book, I have cases where in the city of Camden, the teachers were actually fudging the results of the test, and they were cheating in order to make the students look better than they were. The answer is not doing away with the system. The answer is, let's find out who the cheaters are. Once again, get this book on Freakonomics. And they devised systems to figure out which teachers were cheating. That's what we've got to do. We've got to get rid, instead of saying do away with the system, let's get rid of teachers that cheat. And we know how to find them out. The book will tell you exactly how to sort them out and how they did it in the city of Chicago. They did have teachers that were cheating. But they've devised a system to figure out who was cheating and who was not cheating, and they began to eliminate the cheaters. That's what I want. I want my kids going to school where teachers are pressured to teach them and are going to be, in fact, penalized that the kids don't learn, and in reality are going to be faced with the fact that if they cheat, they're going to get caught and they're going to lose their jobs. And that would be, see, I'm talking like a Republican now, am I not? But it's about time that we recognize that sometimes the Republicans are right and sometimes the Democrats are right. And I think on this education thing, I'm with Bush, and I hated to say it because my wife remembers when I was giving sermons condemning the Bush's administration's Leave No Child Behind program. It's a terrible program. Logically, it shouldn't work. And you're right. There's going to be cheating. And the answer has been in Chicago, what? Let's run tests to find out who's cheating and who's not cheating. Get the book on Freakonomics and they'll give you the whole story on how they sorted out who was cheating and who wasn't cheating in the Chicago school system and how they were able to get rid of the cheaters. And it was easy to get rid of them. I mean, it's one thing to say to the teachers union, we're getting rid of this teacher because this teacher is inadequate. Because the teachers union will go crazy at that point. But if you can show that the teacher is immoral, you can fire them tomorrow morning. Moral turpitude, it's called. The teacher is cheating. We don't want cheats teaching our kids. So that becomes the kind of logic that begins operative in the system. Yes, there are problems. Yes, the kids do graduate without knowing much about Monet and Cezanne, and they don't know the great music of Handel, and they don't know the great music of Mozart. They don't know these things, and that's a shame. But the truth is, if they know how to read and write, they just might be able to learn something about Mozart after they graduate. My wife will tell you that almost all of my education as a scholar took place after I finished school. As a matter of reality, let's face where you are in college. It's very difficult to get an education while you're in college. You know why? You have to do too much required reading, and you can't read the stuff that's really interesting. You don't have time to read up on Monet or Van Gogh. You don't know anything about Van Gogh's life. You don't have time to do that. You're too busy, what? Studying for your finals, getting your paper done, reading this book for this course and that book for this course. You have to. There was an excellent article in the Waltonian, the school newspaper. Did you see it this last time? And why I don't get an education in college. And it's exactly this, because I have to read all of this stuff that I don't give a hoot about, and the stuff I really want to learn, I don't have a chance to learn. So much so that Eldridge Cleaver, in his book Soul on Ice, says the only place in America where you can really get a good education is in prison. Because then you can read what you want to read, and you've got all the time to do it. And nobody interferes with you. If you want quiet, you go to your cell. And all the rest of the guys are down there watching the ball game, and you can read. The reality is, you don't have any time to get educated when you're in college. You're too busy passing courses. And I always ask students this very interesting question. Here it is. What year are you, Anna?
Senior.
Senior. If you were given the final examination for all the courses you took when you were a sophomore, how well do you think you might do if you had to take them today, right now? Yeah, you'd probably funk them. Yeah. You know, you forgot most of what you learned. Agreed? You forgot most of what you learned. Next question is, what did you do with the textbooks?
I sold a lot.
You sold them? So you sold the textbooks and you forgot what you learned. You know, you'd probably have a hard time even locating the notes from those courses. Yeah. So here we are. She can't remember what she learned. She sold the textbooks, she can't find her notes, and we call this higher education. I hate to say it, you've been had. Whereas if you had a chance to read the stuff you were really interested in, my wife says, you know, my husband, he's a slow reader, and I am a slow reader, but he remembers everything that he reads. Of course I do. I only read stuff I'm interested in. Wouldn't you like to read just the stuff you're interested in? But I won't let you. You try to read your book in class, I will stop you. It may be more interesting than the lecture, but I will stop you. Why? Because I want you to pass this course, and education becomes a matter of passing courses rather than learning anything. Stephanie.
I was going to say, so will you cancel our final so we can read a book that we want to read?
If I was a decent guy, I would do that. But I'm not a decent guy. You've known that from day one. You knew that I was a
jerk.
Just choose
one, the final or the research paper.
There was a great scene. You don't remember the name Abbie Hoffman. He was one of the Chicago 8 rebels. He went to speak at Rio Grande College. They invited as a special speaker this countercultural Chicago 8 revolutionary, wonderful guy. Some of the great quotes for preaching have come from Abbie Hoffman. You say, like which one? They brought him into jail, into the courtroom one day, and the judge said, Mr. Hoffman, this revolution of yours, you make it sound so noble. What about all the innocent bystanders who get hurt in the middle of this revolution? Answer, sir, in a revolution, the bystanders are never innocent. Now, if that doesn't preach, I don't know what preaches. What about all these innocent bystanders in a revolution? Bystanders are never innocent. Ooh, that's heavy. Time and time again. He showed up one day dressed as Uncle Sam. And they say, why are you wearing this costume? Because when you get up in the morning, Judge, you either put on a costume or a uniform. Think of the profundity of that. You either put on a costume or a uniform. Great quotes. But he goes to Rio Grande to speak, and he gets up and he says to the students, why are you here? Nobody answers. So he yells it again. Why are you here? Nobody answers. Finally, somebody says, to get a diploma. His assistant had gotten the names of every student in the student body and had diplomas from the school made up so that you forged, so they looked like regular diplomas from the university. And he called out names, and they gave out diplomas to everybody. He said, now that you all have a diploma from the school, let me ask you again. Why are you here? Whoa, is this powerful stuff? He actually closed down the school because he told the students how to disrupt the system. He told the students how to disrupt the system. One was that the students should all go to the library and each of them check out 20 books. And they put the books in big piles in the dormitory. And they, he just disrupted the whole place. And he had reason for it, because he wanted to show the shallowness of higher education. These are interesting questions to be raised as you go into the whole study of how does education function in inner city and what happens in the city. And incidentally, what we point out and what we know is the more urbanized young people are, the more television they watch. The more urbanized they are, the less they are capable of reading. The more urbanized they are, the less they are capable of doing mathematics. And I don't even have to convince you of this, because you worked in Chester and you had to deal with the students out of Chester High School. And if these, you don't understand Chester High School unless you understand that these kids have to go to school every day and they don't know how to read and write and do arithmetic, and the frustration level is so high that it's not surprising that every other day there's a major fight, if not a mob fight, in Chester High. You can, in fact, put kids into a situation where they're that frustrated and then expect that there's going to be peace in the hallways. Do you begin to see how you begin to analyze and say, what is the connection between television? And we're not even talking about the violence on television. Everybody says how many murders they see and how many rapes they see and how many. Forget all of that. Just talk about the technical changes and how it's affecting reading and writing and arithmetic, and how the educational system doesn't educate anybody. And these kids are going to high school and they're frustrated and they're angry. And the anger radiates through the school. Radiates through the school. And the whole place is angry. And there's this whole system has disintegrated over the last 30 years. The anger level in the city has gone higher and higher and higher. And my wife is right. She doesn't want to go into the city. She doesn't want, because you walk down the street and these guys walk at you and there's anger on their faces. And you wonder, are they going to slit my throat? Are they going to kill me? And they talk nasty. The anger that comes from frustration. Thomas?
The whole system still kind of bothers me, I guess. And so, like, if you expect the least out of students, aren't you just going to get the bare minimum? And then, like, if we're supposed to be working towards empowering students, empowering communities, are we really empowering them if we're expecting the least out of them?
There it is, if we're expecting the least out of them. Note, in the Bush administration, we're expecting them to approve every year. We're expecting them to do better. And we don't care who you are, I still expect you to do better than you did before. I expect higher levels of achievement. What teachers expect goes up. Namely, you play on a basketball team, and everybody's fouled out but you. All the bench is gone. But the point is, there came games where we were up against tough competition, and everybody would, the entire starting lineup would foul out. And the subs would go in. And you know what, guys, who really never did much in practice, all of a sudden the coach was saying, it's up to you now. It's up to you now. Whoa. And all of a sudden these guys performed way above, because we need for you to do it. When the teacher needs for you to learn, it can raise the expectations dramatically. And that's what I'm saying here. The teacher needs the student to learn. In the old system, the teacher didn't need for the student to learn. Didn't need for the student to learn. No pressure on the teacher, no pressure on the student. When it's dependent on whether or not the student learns as to whether or not he or she keeps the job and whether the school gets funding, I have a need for you to learn. And when I need for you to learn, all of a sudden, I say, come on, Thomas, you can do it, baby. And I will prod you, and I will push you, and I will demand more of you. And the more I demand, the more I will expect. And if you don't deliver, I'm going to be angry.
Is there a difference between a need for you to learn and a need for you to pass a test? And I hear what you're saying about, like, it's better, but are they I've met students in the high schools in Philadelphia that they can't critically think.
I know.
I mean, there's no...
You're absolutely right. They cannot critically think. Do you think schools teach you to critically think if you don't know how to read and write and do arithmetic?
No, but I mean, I don't... I think that it creates a culture where, like, you just learn that and they don't go... You don't push beyond that.
I can hardly argue with you. Yeah. I would like kids to come out as cultured, sophisticated people who are able to think critically. You saw the exam that I gave you. You're going to have to think critically. You're going to have to do imagination. I use the word imagination. You're going to have to use your imagination in putting material that you read and that you've heard and put it together to put together a creative essay. Will the student be able to do this? The answer is probably not very well. But before we do anything else, let's make sure they can read and write and do arithmetic. The answer is yes, it would be great if we could do all of this other stuff. But you want to get some hard-nosed conservatives and says, look, all I really care about is whether you can read and write and do arithmetic. You got the three R's down. Note, they don't even spell it right. Arithmetic is with an R. Three R's. Reading, writing, and you ever stop to think about that? Three R's. Do we have those down, Pat? Any other questions? Yes, Nancy, and then you, Chris.
I'm wondering how I'm not yet ready to buy the No Child Left Behind thing. I have friends in inner city schools who are teachers and would never have the energy to say, go for it, you go for it, you're going to make it. They're downtrodden from the horrible failure of the establishment. And also, I thought this was brilliant in that one of my friends that's a teacher in an inner city high school said, out of 8 classes, I have 3 students with potential. She said, yes, do all the other kids have potential? Do I feel for them? Yes. But can I even get them to sit in their chair during the day? No. So I'm going to focus what little energy I have left on those 3 students. So I then say, because you've discussed so much about the church, does the church have a responsibility to my friends who are teachers or to the educational system in the city if the church is to be this?
Yeah.
Because what is the answer here?
I want you to read the book. Well, because one of the things that happens in this situation is a very simple one. There are little things that a church can do. For instance, I propose what I've seen happen in a place called Homewood, Arkansas. A church became very concerned about the teachers. Twice a year, they have these wonderful dinners at a fancy hotel for all the teachers. And they honor them, and they call them by name, and they give them presents, and they fall all over them and thank them for all they're doing for the children of the community. Once again, these teachers, friends of yours, whoever says thank you? Whoever says you've done something wonderful?
And certainly not the church.
Certainly not the church. As a matter of fact, the church just does the opposite. I listen to these yokels on Christian radio who talk about all the teachers who are teaching secular humanism. You've heard that line, haven't you? We've got to get our kids, and the Southern Baptist Convention actually put a motion on the floor for all Southern Baptist children to be pulled out of public schools. It didn't pass, but they put a motion on the floor to end public education for our children because they're being taught secular humanistic values. It's just insane. Who thanks them? Who lifts them up? Who says, you're wonderful people? I don't know how you do it. You're dealing with kids who have been watching television for 6.5 hours a day. No teachers in my day ever had to put up with what you're putting up with. Your parents come in, they yell at you. They used to yell at the kids, now they yell at you. How do you do it? How do we say thank you to these people? It might begin with simply the local church in the city making sure that the teachers are thanked a couple of times a year. And not just said thank you, but giving lovely presents, giving certificates to go to the department store. Here's a $100 certificate for you to go and buy something. That's what they do at this church. They give every teacher a $100 certificate. A dinner, you know, when you're going to get a $100 certificate and a dinner, the $100 certificate particularly, do you think the teachers are going to show up for the dinner and everybody falls all over them? It's a simple thing, but we don't do it. And it's about time we begin to ask those kinds of questions. But, you know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer once called himself the man for the others. That's a good phrase. 3 kids, Dietrich Bonhoeffer would say, and what about the others? And he says the church's responsibility is to say, what are we going to do about the others? Your teacher is frustrated, upset, Do you see? When I said, what are we going to do at the town meeting? Remember I talked about the town meeting that the church held? And they held one at Mount Carmel Baptist. They hold them at Mount Carmel Baptist Church, just like I said, at the town meeting. And the people come in. And when they found out that the school up the street wasn't doing a good job in education, note, remember the rule. Whatever we're going to do to improve the school has got to be done with resources that exist in this room. Remember, that was the rule when we had the town meeting. And the teachers complained that one of the reasons why they couldn't teach is because they had four or five kids in the class who were major discipline problems. That's simple. We'll send some mothers in there to sit in the back of the room. And if you know the mothers in West Philadelphia, they're big. Fold their arms and sit there. You misbehave, I'm going to take you out of the class. See, the teacher couldn't do that. I'm going to take you out of class. I'm going to take you downstairs. And you got to understand, in the city, when that happens, when that big mama gets up and gets that kid and by the hand is pulling him out of the class, everybody else in the class does what? What do you think the rest of the kids do?
Shape up.
No, they don't shake up. They do something else. As this kid's being dragged out of class, what do? They laugh at him. The ultimate thing that you don't want to have happen to you in an inner city school is all the kids in the class laugh at you. So the next kid, what? Straightens up. Not because he's afraid of being punished. He's afraid of being laughed at. They begin to get the picture. And all of a sudden, the school began to improve. But here's what the church should do. The church should say, these teachers are having a hard time. What can we do to help them? I know what we can do. We can take some older women and put them in classes and make sure that these kids who are creating the problems don't create the problems. Oh, we got one more question here. Steph?
You spoke before when you were talking about churches, how like there's the 9 levels of economic social classes, and they use different languages. It's a vestibule versus a foyer versus a nave or whatever these different words are. When you have a standardized test for an entire state or for an entire country, there are children in rural communities or poverty level communities that for the arithmetic section in the word problems, there are things that they don't recognize, that they don't understand. For the reading and writing, they might have reading and writing skills, but they don't have the comprehension of certain concepts and certain language that's used in those. You talk about Urban Promise a lot. And ABC in 2020 did a special on Urban Promise just this past year. And there was a young boy who started school who, when the first day in the classroom, the teacher asked him, like, what do you eat when you wake up in the morning? And what do you eat before you go to bed? And he wasn't even familiar with the words breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Like, when he said, what do you eat before bed? He's like, I don't eat anything before bed. Like, they just don't have
the
understanding of those concepts. So when you have standardized tests, there's basic injustices that do not communicate to certain people groups because it's written on a middle-class suburban level.
Brilliant critique. Absolutely right. Is there anybody that's going to argue with her that, in fact, the tests are biased, favoring certain socioeconomic groups? Anybody going to argue with that?
The same was true with IQ tests.
Yeah, exactly. IQ tests. Here's the response of people like Charles Murray, who is the social darling of the conservatives. Yes, you're right. The language, the math, the whole test is constructed to serve the interest of a particular cultural perspective on reality. And people may be very brilliant, but if they're not part of that culture, they're going to do poorly in the test. To which Charles Murray answers, that's right. But hear me, he says. This is the system in which the child is going to have to function if he's going to be successful in the American society. He has to be able to function in this system. You may not like the fact that he may be brilliant and can't function in this system, but this is the system. And if you can't function in it, you're going to fail. And what we've got to do is we've got to get the kid to function in this system. And the only answer to the problem is this. The test only tests out how effective this individual will be able to function within this total system. And that's where the argument is. May I point out what George Herbert Mead, very important name. You really need to know this one. What George Herbert Mead says, this is worth learning. George Herbert Mead, one of the leaders in American sociology, developed the school of thought, which is becoming more and more important. He developed in the early part of the 20th century. George Herbert Mead developed the concept of symbolic interaction. And here's what he said, and this is what's coming to the fore right now, particularly as the deconstruction movement emerges in language and in linguistic analysis, logical positivism. And that is this. Whether you like it or not, we think in words. And there are certain thoughts you can have in one language that you can't have in another language. That's why if you go to seminary, they say you have to learn Greek and Hebrew. You never learn it well enough to do anything worthwhile with it. They think you're going to learn it well enough. But what they're hoping is that you'll be able to learn Greek and Hebrew well enough so that you're able to think in the language. In the old days of Catholicism, priests were able to dream in Latin. They always said, you're now ready to graduate when you can dream in Latin. When you learn a language, you learn more than just words. You learn a whole array of thoughts that are impossible to express in other languages. In short, there are certain thoughts you can think in German that you can't think in English. There are certain thoughts you can think in French that you can't think in German. Languages are, in fact, defining of the thought processes. That's why the most important indice of academic success going into college is your verbal score. That's what they will look at more than any other. Because in reality, you may be very brilliant. You may have the capacity to think. But if you don't have the language, you can't think the thoughts. That's the point. Language gives you the vehicles with which to think the thoughts. That's symbolic interactionism. The point would be this. You're right. These kids over here don't know the language over here. They're very bright. They know another language. And as a matter of fact, you can create an intelligence test using their language, and the kids in the middle class will fail. You know that, don't you? I think your own experience has revealed.
Which is why I'm against standardized.
Yeah, I'm saying, but this is the reality. The problem is, and this is where we as liberals get really uptight, we want to treat people as individuals. And the reality is, you have to live in a standardized world. When you go into a particular job, there are standards that they expect you to measure up to. And the question is not whether you are bright, not whether you are intelligent, but can you fit into this standardized system that we have established? And if you can't fit into the system, we have to get rid of you. You may be very bright. You may be very intelligent. As a matter of fact, a good example is that some of the most brilliant people of our day did not fit into the system. Albert Einstein. Bill Gates did not fit into the system, and they were brilliant, do you see? But most people who don't fit into the system do not become Albert Einstein and do not become Bill Gates. They become failures. And you say, I'm against a unified system. You know what, Stephanie? You would have been wonderful back in the 60s, because that's what the whole rebellion was against. A standardized culture where everybody had to conform to the system, and the hippies were saying at the top of their lungs, and they were morally right, this is wrong. You can't expect everybody to fit into the same system. This is wrong. They were right. The problem is that after the dust cleared and the dust settled, guess what? There was the system, still there, and the people who could not function in the system failed. There is a system out there. And yes, you do have to learn the language of that system. Language, to use Kantian terms, are your a priori categories for organizing empirical reality. That was a sophisticated statement, but that's the way it is. Language are the categorical imperatives with which you organize the empirical reality. So when you look at something, what you see is largely determined by the language you have learned growing up. And you will see things in certain ways. Incidentally, the French Impressionists were big on this, painters. This is where painting and sociology comes into play again. You see, you look at a leaf, and what color is a leaf on a tree? Green. Because you've been socialized to believe that a leaf is green. However, the Impressionist doesn't look at the tree and see the colors you expect to see. He sees colors that you don't expect to see. And if you go to an art museum and look at an Impressionist painting, you say, oh, that's so beautiful. And you look at it, And the tree, the leaf isn't green at all. It's about eight other colors painted brilliantly together. Monet, and you can go to the Philadelphia Art Museum and check this out. Monet was great at this. He would go and he would take a picture. Like, he has a wonderful series of paintings of a pond. He has another series of paintings of a cathedral in, I can't think of the name of the city, but he sets up five easels. Early in the morning, he paints from this easel. 10 o'clock in the morning, he paints on this one. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he paints on this one. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he paints on this one. It's the same building. You see, it's the same building, and yet the colors are completely different in each, because all during the day, the sunlight is changing, and the colors are changing. But because we have a priori assumptions of what we're going to see, we say, oh, that building's gray. We'll paint it gray. It's not gray. It's supposed to be gray, but it's not gray. The sunlight has changed the color. Here's what sociologists talk about, Durkheim particularly. Your a priori categories of interpretation. What an interesting phrase. Your a priori categories of interpretation. You do not come neutral. You see, it was the old British empiricist who said the mind is a blank tablet and things are impressed on it. It is not a blank tablet. You come with a priori categories of interpretation. You come with expectations of what you're supposed to see. And what you're supposed to see is what you see, even if the reality is otherwise. And the thing that makes French Impressionism so beautiful to look at, and it is beautiful, is that the French Impressionists capture the colors that are really there, not the colors you expect to see. And that's why their pictures literally radiate and come alive and have a reality that the other paintings don't. As a matter of fact, you can go to the next room and look at these Renaissance painters, and it's beautiful, and the colors are perfect, and you say, why don't these paintings, my wife will tell you, when I take her into the other rooms, she says, these paintings are boring. I want to go and see Cezanne. I want to see Renoir. I want to see... Because there's an aliveness there in that they come apart from reality. All art, in the end, is revolutionary because it breaks us out of the standardized perceptions of reality that we are socialized into having, right? We are socialized into perceiving the world in a particular way. And good art breaks you out of it. That's why, Stephanie, if you want to create revolutionaries, the thing to do is put them in English literature and in art appreciation. During the 60s, if you looked and tried to find out which college students were creating all the trouble on campus, it wasn't the people in the chemistry department. It wasn't even the kids in the sociology department. It was the kids who were taking English literature and music and art. These were the dangerous people. These were the scary people because they had what? Art does this. This is why art is so important. Art breaks you out of the standardized perceptions of reality. Is that wonderful? I think it is. I think it's absolutely wonderful. But artists are notably unsuccessful people in the system, aren't they? They're notably unsuccessful. But then, of course, it depends on what you mean by success. If you mean being fully alive, not being put into a box, and so I end the course by singing a little song for you. It's by Pete Seeger. Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tack, little boxes, all the same. You know the song, don't you, Chris? There are blue ones, there are white ones, there are brown ones, there are yellow ones, and they're all made out of ticky-tack, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all go to the university where they're all put into boxes, little boxes, all the same. There are doctors, there are lawyers, and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tack, and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course, and they all drink their martinis dry, and they all have pretty children, and their children go to school, and their children go to summer camp, and then to the university, where they're all put into boxes, little boxes, all the same. And Stephanie, you know what's wrong with you? You continually think outside the box. You are dangerous, woman. We've got to eliminate people like you. And if you were in Hitler's era, we would make sure we would take care of you and not have to have these troubling questions raised. And that goes for you too, Thomas. You're no better than she is. On this happy note, you're absolutely right. I mean, I can't argue with you. You're absolutely right. You're saying, but doesn't this stifle creativity, imagination? Doesn't it put people into little boxes and they all come out thinking the same and using the same language? And people from other socioeconomic groups that do not fit into this box do not succeed in the system. They do not play on the golf course. They do not send their children to summer camp. They do not go to the university. They are outside the system. They are barbarians. They are marginal. They don't belong. If you want to fit in the system, say, now that's a good question. Which is the real point? Good note to end on. In education, do we really want to educate people, or do we simply want to socialize them into the dominant system of the culture? Two different purposes of education, right? You want people to become educated and individual. You want them to actualize their potentiality as human beings. That's dangerous. Wouldn't it be better if we just socialized everybody into the system so that they all fit perfectly? There was a functional fit between the way they come out of school. And this was your upset. I could just feel the upset in the whole class as we talked about this. This is not what I want to happen to my kids. People, it all depends. Do you want your kid to fit into the system or not? And the answer to the question is biblical. Romans 12, 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, that you present yourselves as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And as J.B. Phillips translates the second world verse, and don't let the world around you squeeze you into its little box, but let the Holy Spirit invade you and transform you from within so that you can live out your life in the world in such a way that they see that the will of God for your life is better than anything that the society has to offer. Does that preach? You bet it preaches. And so the real question is, do we want to create good Americans? Or do we want to create Christians who are, in the end, if they are Christians, nonconformist? Obviously, you would opt, and I would opt, for Christians. I'm sure of that.